This passed, the frigate took a more decided westerly direction and scoured the central waters of the Pacific. Commander Farragut thought, and with reason, that it was better to remain in deep water and keep clear of continents or islands, which the beast itself seemed to shun, perhaps because there was not enough water for him, suggested the greater part of the crew. The frigate passed at some distance from the Marquesas and the Sandwich Islands, crossed the Tropic of Cancer, and made for the China Seas. We were on the theater of the last diversions of the monster, and, to say truth, we no longer lived on board. The entire ship's crew were undergoing a nervous excitement, of which I can give no idea. They could not eat, they could not sleep. 20 times a day a misconception or an optical illusion of some sailor seated on the taffrail would cause dreadful perspirations, and these emotions, 20 times repeated, kept us in a state of excitement so violent that a reaction was unavoidable. And truly reaction soon showed itself. For 3 months, during which a day seemed an age, the Abraham Lincoln furrowed all the waters of the Northern Pacific, running at whales, making sharp deviations from her course, veering suddenly from one tack to another, stopping suddenly, putting on steam, and backing ever and anon at the risk of deranging her machinery. And not one point of the Japanese or American coast was left unexplored. The warmest partisans of the enterprise now became its most ardent detractors. Reaction mounted from the crew to the captain himself, and certainly had it not been for the resolute determination on the part of Captain Farragut, the frigate would have headed due southward. This useless search could not last much longer. The Abraham Lincoln had nothing to reproach herself with. She had done her best to succeed. Never had an American ship's crew shown more zeal or patience. Its failure could not be placed to their charge. There remained nothing but to return. This was represented to the commander. The sailors could not hide their discontent, and the service suffered. I will not say there was a mutiny on board, but after a reasonable period of obstinacy, Captain Farragut, as Columbus did, asked for 3 days' patience. If, in 3 days, the monster did not appear, the man at the helm should give 3 turns of the wheel, and the Abraham Lincoln would make for the European seas. This promise was made on the 2nd of November. It had the effect of rallying the ship's crew. The ocean was watched with renewed attention. Each one wished for a last glance in which to sum up his remembrance. Glasses were used with feverish activity. It was a grand defiance given to the giant narwhal, and he could scarcely fail to answer the summons and appear. 2 days passed. The steam was at half pressure. 1,000 schemes were tried to attract the attention and stimulate the apathy of the animal in case it should be met in those parts. Large quantities of bacon were trailed in the wake of the ship, to the great satisfaction, I must say, of the sharks. Small craft radiated in all directions round the Abraham Lincoln as she lay to, and did not leave a spot of the sea unexplored. But the night of the 4th of November arrived, without the unveiling of this submarine mystery. The next day, the 5th of November, at 12, the delay would, morally speaking, expire. After that time, Commander Farragut, faithful to his promise, was to turn the course to the southeast and abandon forever the northern regions of the Pacific. The frigate was then in 31 degrees 15 minutes north latitude and 136 degrees 42 minutes east longitude. The coast of Japan still remained less than 200 miles to leeward. Night was approaching. They had just struck 8 bells. Large clouds veiled the face of the moon, then in its first quarter. The sea undulated peacefully under the stern of the vessel. At that moment I was leaning forward on the starboard netting. Conseil, standing near me, was looking straight before him. The crew, perched in the ratlins, examined the horizon which contracted and darkened by degrees. Officers with their night glasses scoured the growing darkness. Sometimes the ocean sparkled under the rays of the moon, which darted between 2 clouds, Then all trace of light was lost in the darkness. In looking at Conseil, I could see he was undergoing a little of the general influence. At least, I thought so. Perhaps for the first time, his nerves vibrated to a sentiment of curiosity. "Come, Conseil," said I. "This is the last chance of pocketing the $2,000.
"May I be permitted to say, sir," replied Conseil, "that I never reckoned on getting the prize, and had the government of the Union offered $100,000, it would have been none the poorer."
"You are right, Conseil. It is a foolish affair after all, and one upon which we entered too lightly. What time lost, what useless emotions! We should have been back in France 6 months ago."
"In your little room, sir," replied Conseil, "and in your museum, sir. And I should have already classed all your fossils, sir. And the Barbarossa would have been installed in its cage in the Jardin des Plantes, and have drawn all the curious people of the capital."
"As you say, Conseil. I fancy we shall run a fair chance of being laughed at for our pains."
"That's tolerably certain," replied Conseil quietly. "I think they will make fun of you, sir. And, must I say it?"
"Go on, my good friend."
"Well, sir, you will only get your deserts."
"Indeed?"
"When one has the honor of being a savant as you are, sir, one should not expose oneself to—"
Conseil had not time to finish his compliment. In the midst of general silence, a voice had just been heard. It was the voice of Ned Land, shouting, "Look out there! The very thing we are looking for! On our weather beam!" Chapter 6. At Full Steam. At this cry, the whole ship's crew hurried towards the harpooner. Commander, officers, masters, sailors, cabin boys. Even the engineers left their engines, and the stokers their furnaces. The order to stop her had been given, and the frigate now simply went on by her own momentum. The darkness was then profound, and however good the Canadian's eyes were, I asked myself how he had managed to see, and what he had been able to see. My heart beat as if it would break, but Ned Land was not mistaken, and we all perceived the object he pointed to. At 2 cables' length from the Abraham Lincoln on the starboard quarter, the sea seemed to be illuminated all over. It was not a mere phosphoric phenomenon. The monster emerged some fathoms from the water, and then threw out that very intense but mysterious light mentioned in the report of several captains. This magnificent irradiation must have been produced by an agent of great shining power. The luminous part traced on the sea an immense oval, much elongated, the center of which condensed a burning heat, whose overpowering brilliancy died out by successive gradations.
"It is only a massing of phosphoric particles," cried one of the officers.
"No, sir, certainly not," I replied. "That brightness is of an essentially electrical nature. Besides, see, see, it moves. It is moving forwards, backwards. It is darting towards us."
A general cry arose from the frigate.
"Silence," said the captain. "Up with the helm! Reverse the engines!"
The steam was shut off, and the Abraham Lincoln, beating to port, described a semicircle.
"Right the helm! Go ahead!" cried the captain.
These orders were executed, and the frigate moved rapidly from the burning light. I was mistaken. She tried to sheer off, but the supernatural animal approached with a velocity double her own. We gasped for breath. Stupefaction more than fear made us dumb and motionless. The animal gained on us, sporting with the waves. It made the round of the frigate, which was then making 14 knots, and enveloped it with its electric rings like luminous dust. Then it moved away 2 or 3 miles, leaving a phosphorescent track, like those volumes of steam that the express trains leave behind. All at once, from the dark line of the horizon whither it retired to gain its momentum, The monster rushed suddenly towards the Abraham Lincoln with alarming rapidity, stopped suddenly about 20 feet from the hull, and died out, not diving under the water, for its brilliancy did not abate. But suddenly, and as if the source of this brilliant emanation was exhausted. Then it reappeared on the other side of the vessel, as if it had turned and slid under the hull. Any moment a collision might have occurred which would have been fatal to us. However, I was astonished at the maneuvers of the frigate. She fled, and did not attack. On the captain's face, generally so impassive, was an expression of unaccountable astonishment.
"Mr. Aronnax," he said, "I do not know with what formidable being I have to deal, and I will not imprudently risk my frigate in the midst of this darkness. Besides, how attack this unknown thing? How defend oneself from it? Wait for daylight, and the scene will change."
"You have no further doubt, Captain, of the nature of the animal?"
"No, sir. It is evidently a gigantic narwhal, and an electric one."
"Perhaps," added I, "one can only approach it with a torpedo."
"Undoubtedly," replied the captain. "If it possesses such dreadful power, it is the most terrible animal that ever was created. That is why, sir, I must be on my guard."
The crew were on their feet all night. No one thought of sleep. The Abraham Lincoln, not being able to struggle with such velocity, had moderated its pace and sailed at half speed. For its part, the narwhal, imitating the frigate, let the waves rock it at will, and seemed decided not to leave the scene of the struggle. Towards midnight, however, it disappeared, or, to use a more appropriate term, it died out like a large glowworm. Had it fled? One could only fear, not hope it. But at 7 minutes to 1 o'clock in the morning, a deafening whistling was heard, like that produced by a body of water rushing with great violence. The captain, Ned Land, and I were then on the poop, eagerly peering through the profound darkness.
"Ned Land," asked the commander, "you have often heard the roaring of whales?"
"Often, sir, but never such whales the sight of which brought me in $2,000, if I can only approach within 4 harpoons' length of it."
"But to approach it," said the commander, "I ought to put a whaler at your disposal."
"Certainly, sir."
"That will be trifling with the lives of my men."
"And mine, too," simply said the harpooner.
Towards 2 o'clock in the morning, the burning light reappeared, not less intense, about 5 miles to windward of the Abraham Lincoln. Notwithstanding the distance, and the noise of the wind and sea, one heard distinctly the loud strokes of the animal's tail, and even its panting breath. It seemed that, at the moment that the enormous narwhal had come to take breath at the surface of the water, the air was engulfed in its lungs, like the steam in the vast cylinders of a machine of 2,000 horsepower.
"Hmm," thought I, "a whale with the strength of a cavalry regiment would be a pretty whale."
We were on the qui vive till daylight, and prepared for the combat. The fishing implements were laid along the hammock nettings. The second lieutenant loaded the blunderbusses, which could throw harpoons to the distance of 1 mile, and long duck guns with explosive bullets, which inflicted mortal wounds even to the most terrible animals. Ned Land contented himself with sharpening his harpoon, a terrible weapon in his hands. At 6 o'clock day began to break, and with the first glimmer of light the electric light of the narwhal disappeared. At 7 o'clock the day was sufficiently advanced, but a very thick sea fog obscured our view, and the best spyglasses could not pierce it. That caused disappointment and anger. I climbed the mizzenmast. Some officers were already perched on the mastheads. At 8 o'clock the fog lay heavily on the waves, and its thick scrolls rose little by little. The horizon grew wider and clearer at the same time. Suddenly, just as on the day before, Ned Land's voice was heard.
"The thing itself on the port quarter!" cried the harpooner.
Every eye was turned towards the point indicated. There, a mile and a half from the frigate, a long blackish body emerged a yard above the waves. Its tail, violently agitated, produced a considerable eddy. Never did a tail beat the sea with such violence. An immense track of dazzling whiteness marked the passage of the animal, and described a long curve. The frigate approached the cetacean. I examined it thoroughly. The reports of the Shannon and of the Helvetia had rather exaggerated its size, and I estimated its length at only 250 feet. As to its dimensions, I could only conjecture them to be admirably proportioned. While I watched this phenomenon, two jets of steam and water were ejected from its vents, and rose to the height of 120 feet. Thus I ascertained its way of breathing. I concluded definitely that it belonged to the vertebrate branch, class Mammalia. The crew waited impatiently for their chief's orders. The latter, after having observed the animal attentively, called the engineer. The engineer ran to him.
"Sir," said the commander, "you have steam up?"
"Yes, sir,"
answered the engineer. "Well, make up your fires and put on all steam."
Three hurrahs greeted this order. The time for the struggle had arrived. Some moments after, the two funnels of the frigate vomited torrents of black smoke, and the bridge quaked under the trembling of the boilers. The Abraham Lincoln, propelled by her wonderful screw, went straight at the animal. The latter allowed it to come within half a cable's length. Then, as if disdaining to dive, it took a little turn and stopped a short distance off. This pursuit lasted nearly 3/4 of an hour, without the frigate gaining 2 yards on the cetacean. It was quite evident that, at that rate, we should never come up with it.
"Well, Mr. Land," asked the captain, "do you advise me to put the boats out to sea?"
"No, sir," replied Ned Land, "because we shall not take that beast easily."
"What shall we do, then?"
"Put on more steam if you can, sir. With your leave, I mean to post myself under the bowsprit, and if we get within harpooning distance, I shall throw my harpoon."
"Go, Ned," said the captain. "Engineer, put on more pressure."
Ned Land went to his post. The fires were increased. The screw revolved 43 times a minute, and the steam poured out of the valves. We heaved the log and calculated that the Abraham Lincoln was going at the rate of 18.5 miles an hour. But the accursed animal swam at the same speed. For a whole hour the frigate kept up this pace without gaining 6 feet. It was humiliating for one of the swiftest sailors in the American Navy. A stubborn anger seized the crew. The sailors abused the monster, who, as before, disdained to answer them. The captain no longer contented himself with twisting his beard. He gnawed it. The engineer was called again.
"You have turned full steam on?"
"Yes, sir,"
replied the engineer.
The speed of the Abraham Lincoln increased. Its masts trembled down to their stepping holes, and the clouds of smoke could hardly find their way out of the narrow funnels. They heaved the log a second time.
"Well?" asked the captain of the man at the wheel.
19 miles and 3/10, sir."
"Clap on more steam."
The engineer obeyed. The manometer showed 10 degrees. But the cetacean grew warm itself, no doubt, for without straining itself, it made 19 3/10 miles. What a pursuit! No, I cannot describe the emotion that vibrated through me. Ned Land kept his post, harpoon in hand. Several times the animal let us gain upon it.
"We shall catch it! We shall catch it!" cried the Canadian.
But just as he was going to strike, the cetacean stole away with a rapidity that could not be estimated at less than 30 miles an hour. And even during our maximum of speed, it bullied the frigate, going round and round it. A cry of fury broke from everyone. At noon, we were no further advanced than at 8 o'clock in the morning. The captain then decided to take more direct means.
"Ah," said he, "that animal goes quicker than the Abraham Lincoln.
Very well. We will see whether it will escape these conical bullets. Send your men to the forecastle, sir.
The forecastle gun was immediately loaded and slewed round, but the shot passed some feet above the cetacean, which was half a mile off.
"Another, more to the right," cried the commander. "And $5 to whoever will hit that infernal beast."
An old gunner with a gray beard, that I can see now, with steady eye and grave face, went up to the gun and took a long aim. A loud report was heard, with which were mingled the cheers of the crew. The bullet did its work. It hit the animal, and sliding off the rounded surface, was lost in 2 miles depth of sea. The chase began again, and the captain, leaning towards me, said,
"I will pursue that beast till my frigate bursts up."
"Yes," answered I, "and you will be quite right to do it."
I wished the beast would exhaust itself and not be insensible to fatigue like a steam engine. But it was of no use. Hours passed without it showing any signs of exhaustion. However, it must be said in praise of the Abraham Lincoln that she struggled on indefatigably. I cannot reckon the distance she made under 300 miles during this unlucky day, November the 6th. But night came on and overshadowed the rough ocean. Now I thought our expedition was at an end, and that we should never again see the extraordinary animal. I was mistaken. At 10 minutes to 11 in the evening, the electric light reappeared 3 miles to windward of the frigate, as pure, as intense as during the preceding night. The narwhal seemed motionless. Perhaps, tired with its day's work, it slept, letting itself float with the undulation of the waves. Now was a chance of which the captain resolved to take advantage. He gave his orders. The Abraham Lincoln kept up half steam and advanced cautiously so as not to awake its adversary. It is no rare thing to meet in the middle of the ocean whales so sound asleep that they can be successfully attacked, and Ned Land had harpooned more than one during its sleep. The Canadian went to take his place again under the bowsprit. The frigate approached noiselessly, stopped at 2 cables' lengths from the animal, and following its track. No one breathed. A deep silence reigned on the bridge. We were not 100 feet from the burning focus, the light of which increased and dazzled our eyes. At this moment, leaning on the forecastle bulwark, I saw below me Ned Land grappling the martingale in one hand, brandishing his terrible harpoon in the other, scarcely 20 feet from the motionless animal. Suddenly his arm straightened, and the harpoon was thrown. I heard the sonorous stroke of the weapon, which seemed to have struck a hard body. The electric light went out suddenly, and 2 enormous waterspouts broke over the bridge of the frigate, rushing like a torrent from stem to stern, overthrowing men and breaking the lashings of the spars. A fearful shock followed, and, thrown over the rail without having time to stop myself, I fell into the sea. Chapter 7. An Unknown Species of Whale. This unexpected fall so stunned me that I have no clear recollection of my sensations at the time. I was at first drawn down to a depth of about 20 feet. I am a good swimmer, though without pretending to rival Byron or Edgar Poe, who were masters of the art, and in that plunge I did not lose my presence of mind. 2 vigorous strokes brought me to the surface of the water. My first care was to look for the frigate. Had the crew seen me disappear? Had the Abraham Lincoln veered round? Would the captain put out a boat? Might I hope to be saved? The darkness was intense. I caught a glimpse of a black mass disappearing in the east, its beacon lights dying out in the distance. It was the frigate. I was lost.
"Help! Help!"
I shouted, swimming towards the Abraham Lincoln in desperation. My clothes encumbered me. They seemed glued to my body and paralyzed my movements. I was sinking. I was suffocating.
"Help!"
This was my last cry. My mouth filled with water. I struggled against being drawn down the abyss.
Suddenly my clothes were seized by a strong hand, and I felt myself quickly drawn up to the surface of the sea. And I heard, yes, I heard these words pronounced in my ear. "If Master would be so good as to lean on my shoulder, Master would swim with much greater ease." I seized with one hand my faithful Conseil's arm.
"Is it you?" said I. "You?"
"Myself," answered Conseil, "and waiting Master's orders." "That shock threw you as well as me into the sea?" "No, but being in my master's service, I followed him."
The worthy fellow thought that was but natural.
"And the frigate?" I asked.
"The frigate?" replied Conseil, turning on his back.
"I think that Master had better not count too much on her."
"You think so?"
"I say that, at the time I threw myself into the sea, I heard the men at the wheel say, 'The screw and the rudder are broken.'"
"Broken?"
"Yes, broken by the monster's teeth. It is the only injury the Abraham Lincoln has sustained. But it is a bad lookout for us. She no longer answers her helm."
"Then we are lost."
"Perhaps so," calmly answered Conseil. "However, we still have several hours before us, and one can do a great deal in some hours." Conseil's imperturbable coolness set me up again. I swam more vigorously, but, cramped by my clothes, which stuck to me like a leaden weight, I felt great difficulty in bearing up. Conseil saw this.
"Will Master let me make a slit?" said he.
And, slipping an open knife under my clothes, he ripped them up from top to bottom very rapidly. Then he cleverly slipped them off me, while I swam for both of us. Then I did the same for Conseil, and we continued to swim near to each other. Nevertheless, our situation was no less terrible. Perhaps our disappearance had not been noticed, and if it had been, the frigate could not tack, being without its helm. Conseil argued on this supposition and laid his plans accordingly. This quiet boy was perfectly self-possessed. We then decided that, as our only chance of safety was being picked up by the Abraham Lincoln's boats, we ought to manage so as to wait for them as long as possible. I resolved then to husband our strength, so that both should not be exhausted at the same time. And this is how we managed. While one of us lay on our back, quite still, with arms crossed and legs stretched out, the other would swim and push the other on in front. This towing business did not last more than 10 minutes each, and relieving each other thus, we could swim on for some hours, perhaps till daybreak. Poor chance! But hope is so firmly rooted in the heart of man. Moreover, there were two of us. Indeed, I declare, though it may seem improbable, if I sought to destroy all hope, if I wished to despair, I could not. The collision of the frigate with the Cetacean had occurred about 11 o'clock in the evening before. I reckoned then we should have 8 hours to swim before sunrise, an operation quite practicable if we relieved each other. The sea, very calm, was in our favor. Sometimes I tried to pierce the intense darkness that was only dispelled by the phosphorescence caused by our movements. I watched the luminous waves that broke over my hand, whose mirror-like surface was spotted with silvery rings. One might have said that we were in a bath of quicksilver. Near 1 o'clock in the morning, I was seized with dreadful fatigue. My limbs stiffened under the strain of violent cramp. Conseil was obliged to keep me up, and our preservation devolved on him alone. I heard the poor boy pant. His breathing became short and hurried. I found that he could not keep up much longer.
"Leave me! Leave me!" I said to him.
"Leave my master? Never!" replied he. "I would drown first."
Just then the moon appeared through the fringes of a thick cloud that the wind was driving to the east. The surface of the sea glittered with its rays. This kindly light reanimated us. My head got better again. I looked at all points of the horizon. I saw the frigate.
She was 5 miles from us and looked like a dark mass, hardly discernible. But no boats. I would have cried out, but what good would it have been at such a distance? My swollen lips could utter no sounds. Conseil could articulate some words, and I heard him repeat at intervals, "Help! Help!" Our movements were suspended for an instant. We listened. It might be only a singing in the ear, but it seemed to me as if a cry answered the cry from Conseil.
"Did you hear?" I murmured.
"Yes, yes."
And Conseil gave one more despairing cry. This time there was no mistake. A human voice responded to ours. Was it the voice of another unfortunate creature, abandoned in the middle of the ocean, some other victim of the shock sustained by the vessel? Or rather, was it a boat from the frigate that was hailing us in the darkness? Conseil made a last effort, and leaning on my shoulder while I struck out in a desperate effort, he raised himself half out of the water, then fell back, exhausted.
"What did you see?"
"I saw," murmured he. "I saw. But do not talk. Reserve all your strength."
What had he seen? Then, I know not why, the thought of the monster came into my head for the first time. But that voice!
The time is past for Jonas to take refuge in whales' bellies. However, Conseil was towing me again. He raised his head sometimes, looked before us, and uttered a cry of recognition, which was responded to by a voice that came nearer and nearer. I scarcely heard it. My strength was exhausted. My fingers stiffened. My hand afforded me support no longer. My mouth, convulsively opening, filled with salt water. Cold crept over me. I raised my head for the last time. Then I sank. At this moment a hard body struck me. I clung to it. Then I felt that I was being drawn up, that I was brought to the surface of the water, that my chest collapsed. I fainted. It is certain that I soon came to, thanks to the vigorous rubbings that I received. I half opened my eyes.
"Conseil,"
I murmured.
"Does master call me?"
asked Conseil. Just then, by the waning light of the moon, which was sinking down to the horizon, I saw a face which was not Conseil's, and which I immediately recognized.
"Ned!" I cried.
"The same, sir, who is seeking his prize," replied the Canadian.
"Were you thrown into the sea by the shock to the frigate?"
"Yes, Professor, but more fortunate than you, I was able to find a footing almost directly upon a floating island."
"An island?"
"Or, more correctly speaking, on our gigantic narwhal."
"Explain yourself, Ned."
"Only I soon found out why my harpoon had not entered its skin and was blunted."
"Why, Ned? Why?"
"Because, Professor, that beast is made of sheet iron."
The Canadian's last words produced a sudden revolution in my brain. I wriggled myself quickly to the top of the being, or object, half out of the water, which served us for a refuge.
I kicked it. It was evidently a hard, impenetrable body, and not the soft substance that forms the bodies of the great marine mammalia. But this hard body might be a bony covering like that of the antediluvian animals, and I should be free to class this monster among amphibious reptiles, such as tortoises or alligators. Well, no. The blackish back that supported me was smooth, polished, without scales. The blow produced a metallic sound, and incredible though it may be, it seemed, I might say, as if it was made of riveted plates. There was no doubt about it. This monster, this natural phenomenon that had puzzled the learned world, and overthrown and misled the imagination of seamen of both hemispheres, it must be owned was a still more astonishing phenomenon, inasmuch as it was a simply human construction. We had no time to lose, however. We were lying upon the back of a sort of submarine boat, which appeared, as far as I could judge, like a huge fish of steel. Ned Land's mind was made up on this point. Conseil and I could only agree with him. Just then a bubbling began at the back of this strange thing, which was evidently propelled by a screw, and it began to move. We had only just time to seize hold of the upper part, which rose about 7 feet out of the water, and happily its speed was not great.
"As long as it sails horizontally," muttered Ned Land, "I do not mind. But if it takes a fancy to dive, I would not give 2 straws for my life."
The Canadian might have said still less. It became really necessary to communicate with the beings, whatever they were, shut up inside the machine. I searched all over the outside for an aperture, a panel, or a manhole, to use a technical expression. But the lines of the iron rivets, solidly driven into the joints of the iron plates, were clear and uniform. Besides, the moon disappeared then, and left us in total darkness. At last this long night passed. My indistinct remembrance prevents my describing all the impressions it made. I can only recall one circumstance. During some lulls of the wind and sea, I fancied I heard several times vague sounds, a sort of fugitive harmony produced by words of command. What was, then, the mystery of this submarine craft, of which the whole world vainly sought an explanation? What kind of beings existed in this strange boat? What mechanical agent caused its prodigious speed? Daybreak appeared. The morning mists surrounded us, but they soon cleared off. I was about to examine the hull, which formed on deck a kind of horizontal platform, when I felt it gradually sinking.
"Oh, confound it!" cried Ned Land, kicking the resounding plate. "Open, you inhospitable rascals!"
Happily, the sinking movement ceased. Suddenly a noise, like ironworks violently pushed aside, came from the interior of the boat. One iron plate was moved. A man appeared, uttered an odd cry, and disappeared immediately. Some moments after, 8 strong men, with masked faces, appeared noiselessly, and drew us down into their formidable machine.
Chapter 8. Mobilis in Mobili. This forcible abduction, so roughly carried out, was accomplished with the rapidity of lightning. I shivered all over. Whom had we to deal with? No doubt some new sort of pirates, who explored the sea in their own way. Hardly had the narrow panel closed upon me when I was enveloped in darkness. My eyes, dazzled with the outer light, could distinguish nothing. I felt my naked feet cling to the rungs of an iron ladder. Ned Land and Conseil, firmly seized, followed me. At the bottom of the ladder a door opened, and shut after us immediately with a bang. We were alone. Where, I could not say, hardly imagine. All was black, and such a dense black that, after some minutes, my eyes had not been able to discern even the faintest glimmer. Meanwhile, Ned Land, furious at these proceedings, gave free vent to his indignation.
"Confound it!" cried he. "Here are people who come up to the Scotch for hospitality. They only just miss being cannibals. I should not be surprised at it, but I declare that they shall not eat me without my protesting."
"Calm yourself, friend Ned, calm yourself," replied Conseil quietly. "Do not cry out before you are hurt. We are not quite done for yet."
"Not quite," sharply replied the Canadian, "but pretty near at all events. Things look black. Happily, my bowie knife I have still, and I can always see well enough to use it. The first of these pirates who lays a hand on me—"
"Do not excite yourself, Ned," I said to the harpooner, "and do not compromise us by useless violence. Who knows that they will not listen to us? Let us rather try to find out where we are." I groped about. In 5 steps I came to an iron wall made of plates bolted together. Then, turning back, I struck against a wooden table, near which were ranged several stools. The boards of this prison were concealed under a thick mat, which deadened the noise of the feet. The bare walls revealed no trace of window or door. Conseil, going round the reverse way, met me,
and we went back to the middle of the cabin, which measured about 20 feet by 10. As to its height, Ned Land, in spite of his own great height, could not measure it. Half an hour had already passed without our situation being bettered, when the dense darkness suddenly gave way to extreme light. Our prison was suddenly lighted, that is to say, it became filled with a luminous matter, so strong that I could not bear it at first. In its whiteness and intensity, I recognized that electric light which played round the submarine boat like a magnificent phenomenon of phosphorescence. After shutting my eyes involuntarily, I opened them, and saw that this luminous agent came from a half-globe, unpolished, placed in the roof of the cabin.
"At last one can see!" cried Ned Land, who, knife in hand, stood on the defensive.
"Yes," said I, "but we are still in the dark about ourselves."
"Let Master have patience," said the imperturbable Conseil.
The sudden lighting of the cabin enabled me to examine it minutely. It only contained a table and 5 stools. The invisible door might be hermetically sealed. No noise was heard. All seemed dead in the interior of this boat. Did it move? Did it float on the surface of the ocean? Or did it dive into its depths? I could not guess. A noise of bolts was now heard. The door opened, and 2 men appeared. One was short, very muscular, broad-shouldered, with robust limbs, strong head, an abundance of black hair, thick mustache, a quick, penetrating look, and the vivacity which characterizes the population of southern France. The second stranger merits a more detailed description. I made out his prevailing qualities directly. Self-confidence, because his head was well set on his shoulders, and his black eyes looked around with cold assurance. Calmness, for his skin, rather pale, showed his coolness of blood. Energy, evinced by the rapid contraction of his lofty brows. And courage, because his deep breathing denoted great power of lungs. Whether this person was 35 or 50 years of age, I could not say. He was tall, had a large forehead, straight nose, a clearly cut mouth, beautiful teeth, with fine taper hands, indicative of a highly nervous temperament. This man was certainly the most admirable specimen I had ever met. One particular feature was his eyes, rather far from each other, and which could take in nearly a quarter of the horizon at once. This faculty, I verified it later, gave him a range of vision far superior to Ned Land's. When this stranger fixed upon an object, his eyebrows met. His large eyelids closed around so as to contract the range of his vision, and he looked as if he magnified the objects lessened by distance, as if he pierced those sheets of water so opaque to our eyes, and as if he read the very depths of the seas. The 2 strangers, with caps made from the fur of the sea otter, and shod with sea boots of seal skin, were dressed in clothes of a particular texture, which allowed free movement of the limbs. The taller of the 2, evidently the chief on board, examined us with great attention, without saying a word. Then, turning to his companion, talked with him in an unknown tongue. It was a sonorous, harmonious, and flexible dialect, the vowels seeming to admit a very varied accentuation. The other replied by a shake of the head, and added 2 or 3 perfectly incomprehensible words. Then he seemed to question me by a look. I replied, in good French, that I did not know his language. But he seemed not to understand me, and my situation became more embarrassing.
"If Master were to tell our story," said Conseil, "perhaps these gentlemen may understand some words."
I began to tell our adventures, articulating each syllable clearly, and without omitting 1 single detail. I announced our names and rank, introducing in person Professor Aronnax, his servant Conseil, and Master Ned Land, the harpooner. The man with the soft, calm eyes listened to me quietly, even politely, and with extreme attention.
but nothing in his countenance indicated that he had understood my story. When I finished, he said not a word. There remained one resource, to speak English. Perhaps they would know this almost universal language. I knew it, as well as the German language, well enough to read it fluently, but not to speak it correctly. But anyhow, we must make ourselves understood. "Go on in your turn," I said to the harpooner. "Speak your best Anglo-Saxon and try to do better than I." Ned did not beg off and recommenced our story. To his great disgust, the harpooner did not seem to have made himself more intelligible than I had. Our visitors did not stir. They evidently understood neither the language of England nor of France. Very much embarrassed, after having vainly exhausted our speaking resources, I knew not what part to take, when Conseil said, "If master will permit..."